Okay, we're visiting with Dale McGarvey. Dale served in the Montana House of Representatives in the 1957 and 1959 sessions and has been involved in public affairs both before and after his service in the legislature. And Dale is a lawyer. Dale, what was the legislature like when you experienced it in 1957 as a freshman legislator? And maybe I'd ask you this too as a kind of a prologue to this question. What motivated you to run for the legislature?
Well, there were several issues that motivated me. The first and foremost issue was the schools. The situation was in Flathead County that we were trying to develop a really good educational program. And the amounts of money that was needed just wasn't forthcoming. In the man I campaigned against was Ori Armstrong. And Ori was Speaker of the House. And my campaign was based on the School Foundation Program. What Ori Armstrong had done is kept the contribution of the state down and the pitch that basically I was making to the voters of Flathead County was that that type of effort not only hurt the schools, but it actually hurt the taxpayers of Flathead County. Because, as you know, there are two companion bills in the legislature, the A and B, and then the funding bill. And if the state doesn't fund the commitment totally, then there's an automatic chargeback on the property taxes. So that was the basis of my campaign. I got a lot of support from people who believed in schools, and the first session of the legislature in 1957, we made some major improvements in connection with the funding of schools. That was probably the whole effort that I wanted to, that was the main thrust of my efforts. The second thing that I was concerned about is the occupational disease bill. And for years and years and years, and I think a lot through the influence of the Anaconda Copper Mining Company, bill after bill in the legislature went down because of the way that, well, the company papers, the whole coalition was too tough for anybody to get legislation through. So in the first session...
Now, Dale, you say coalition, so the Anaconda Company was sort of at the center of what, of a business coalition?
Yes.
Some kind of a...
Yes. Coalition of the Anaconda Company, the Montana Power Company, some wealthy ranchers, and they basically had a stranglehold in connection with getting any progressive legislation through. At any rate, in the 1957 session of the legislature, I was on the Workers' Comp Committee, and we were able to get through the House of Representatives a silicosis or occupational disease bill. I was appointed as a conference member regarding that bill, because
now, of course, what that means is that the bill passed the House of Representatives,
yes,
got over to the Senate, where it was apparently amended.
That's correct.
And so the House wasn't willing to accept the Senate's amendments, and so a committee of negotiators was appointed, three from the House and three from the Senate, called the Conference Committee, and you were one of the three members of the Conference Committee from the House of Representatives.
That's correct. And so we met, and we weren't getting anywhere. And finally, I went to Bob Corrett,
who is the lobbyist for the Montana Power Company.
The lobbyist for Montana Power. And I said to Bob, Bob, you know, we worked hard on this bill. We're willing to strip it down. We're willing to change it. We're willing to do most anything here, but we'd like to get a bill. And Bob Corrett said to me, Dale, let's not argue. Let's vote. And so the House voted in favor of the bill. The Senate voted to kill it. And of course, that was it.
So it died in conference.
The conference committee report was not accepted in the Senate. And so the bill died. The next session of the legislature was...
Now, this silicosis benefits would have been... There would have been some obligation on the part of the Anaconda Company if the bill had passed, for them to pay for these work-related lung ailments of their employees. But Corrett was a lobbyist for the Montana Power Company.
Yes.
Well, any... What?
The next session of the legislature, I think you'll find this to be really interesting. The next session, I was chairman of the House Committee of Workers' Comp. And suddenly, I found on my desk a silicosis bill that had passed through the Senate. And I could hardly believe my eyes when I read it. It was a good bill. And so I went to Al Donahue, chief clerk, and I said, Al, I want you to post that bill up above everything else. Put it right at the top of the list. We're going to put it through the House. We're going to report it out with a due pass out of workers' comp. I want it considered in the whole House, and I wanted to get it down on the governor's desk. And Al did that, and then I started to find out what had happened. Well, what had happened, as I was learning, was that Bob Corrett, who was the lobbyist for the Montana Power Company, and also really a lobbyist for the Anaconda Company, but primarily for one, Montana Power, but they were in bed together, basically, as far as the positions in the legislature. And so Bob Corrett had asked, and this is the reputed story, could not understand how we could have that good a bill on my desk after such a fight last time, in 1957, that came to nothing. Well, at any rate, the story was, and this is what was what I learned at the time, and this was just a lot of rumor, but that Bob Corrett had wanted to be put on the board of directors of the Montana Power Company, which was great, but when he went to the Anaconda Company and he wanted to be on that board too, they said no. And that made Bob Corrett angry. So Bob Corrett said that, well, if you won't accept me on your board of directors, I'm not going to lobby for you either. So what had happened was that Bill Kirkpatrick was then the lobbyist for the Anaconda Company, and he was new, And of course, Bob Corrett knew the people, and he knew how to do things. And before Bill Kirkpatrick could even get his feet on the ground, Bob Corrett had put that bill through the Senate. And here it was in my committee in the House. And so we went into the Committee of the Whole, and I asked that the bill be passed, and it was passed with a tremendous vote in favor of the bill. And I went down to the governor's office, and along the way I ran into Bill Kirkpatrick, and I said, "Bill, is there going to be a silicosis bill, occupational disease bill in the state?" And Bill Kirkpatrick had a very long face, and he said, "Well, yes, there was, that his immediate predecessor, Bob Corrett, had gotten down to the governor before he could get there. And yes, we were going to have a silicosis bill."
Meaning that if he had gotten there before Bob, that Hugo Aronson might have vetoed the bill?
Well, he didn't feel like he really had a chance. It just happened so fast. And Bill then said to me, "You know, you never gave me a chance in the House." And I said, "Well, I wasn't about to. I knew once you'd get your forces gathered that I'd have a battle on my hands, and I wasn't going to let those forces form if I could avoid it."
Now, Dale, were you in a leadership position where you could kind of influence the agenda?
Al Donahue and I were very, very good friends. And yes, I was in a leadership position in this sense. I went to the legislature in 57, and I listened to, well, the idea of getting, the idea of speaking, and I finally developed a style where you could put an awful lot of emotion into your voice, and in the limited time you had on the floor, I learned how to do that, and it took two sessions to do it. The first session I wasn't all that great at it. In fact, Dr. DeMond and I were in Toastmasters together, and
who was Dr. DeMond?
Dr. DeMond was a doctor here in Kalispell.
Okay.
He came over the legislature the first time, and then the second time he came over, and he said, "What happened, Dale?" He said, "I've been Toastmaster with you, you know, for more than a year, and they say you're formidable." And that's what happened. And it is...
You developed a persuasive speaking style?
Yes, I did. And I'll tell you who I watched very carefully was Wellington D. Rankin. And the first session, I heard him, and he was good, and he was persuasive.
What made him good and persuasive?
Well, it was the ability to put a lot of emotion into his voice, number one. But number two, that he had the ability to move the ideas that he had so quickly that your mind would be absorbing one, and then he was moving into another, and all this emotion kept hitting you, and he kept just hammering away until your mind really didn't have a chance to analyze very carefully anything, but at the end of it, he basically had at least given you the impression that, well, you really don't have any good answers to what he's saying here, mm-hmm. do you now? And so this was his technique, and I watched that carefully, and I.
Saw him in the courtroom, or you said?
No, I saw him in the legislature.
I see. Testify on a bill before a committee.
Well, it was after, I think, the close of, it was getting down to close of the legislature, and what the argument was something about the power of the legislature under those circumstances. And no, it was a legislative action he was in the middle of, and he was winning the day on that one, and he did win the day on that one. But at any rate, I watched him carefully, and I thought, well, you know, you have a very limited time, and so what I would do in the second session of the legislature is, when bills were coming up that I wanted to support, I would go upstairs, find a room where nobody else was there. I would go in and organize my thoughts, make a little, I would say, head notes, just not write it all out, just one thought, the main themes, and so I had a whole series of them all pretty well lined out, and then I would go down on the floor, and when the bill came up, why, this is what I would do. And I put through at least 12 bills the second session.
Really?
And that, you know, that's...
Importantly, due to that rhetoric technique.
Yes. Once that the other legislators learned that I had it, then they would come to me and say, Dale, would you sign on this bill? Do you really like this bill? I remember one time we had a bill that had to do with the university, and we're giving the university a lot of power, and Jim Felt came to me and he said, Dale, in one way I think that this is all right.
Jim Felt was a state representative, a Republican from Billings.
From Billings.
Who later was Speaker of the House, I think.
Well, he was a representative as I was. I never had any office, you know. I wasn't the majority floor leader or anything. Mm-hmm. But I just at any rate, Jim came to me, and so I thought that what he said was correct, and it was the bill had that by that time come out of committee. It was on the floor, and so I made a motion. And I amended my own bill on the floor of the House, and I got the amendment through, and then the bill went through the House with the support of both sides of the aisle. One of the other things that I found in the legislature was that you need to reach across the aisle. And in that case, it was a reaching across to Jim Felt, but most of the time, the person I contacted on the opposite side of the aisle was Fred Brewer, and Fred had a good level head, and we could talk things over and make common cause, and if there were, you know, some gives and takes, and then I think that's one of the reasons that I was successful in getting at least those 12 bills through, is that I had some support on the Republican side of the House. It wasn't a Democratic thing or a Republican thing or anything like that. It was just, I thought, good government.
And Fred Broder, who was a Republican representative from here in
Flathead County, that's
was
correct.
Someone who you had a good relationship with and could talk to.
And
of course,
that.
That's interesting, too, because in order to get to the legislature, in the system we had then, when we elected either three or four representatives at large, I've forgotten which.
Yes. Well,
you were essentially running against Fred.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Right. Well, but not so much. I mean, well, the first session I ran against
Ori Armstrong.
And I really did not like what he was doing as far as education at all was concerned. He was on the other side of the state superintendent of schools. My basic pitch is that we have a rich state, and if we will only fund by all of the ways that you can raise revenue at the state level, then we'll be able to tax and fairly, and we won't have all of these taxes dropped back on the shoulders of the property taxpayers of Flathead County. And so that was the first thing. And the second thing that I wanted was the occupational disease bill. When I picked up that bill in the as chairman of the Workers' Comp Committee in the 1959 session, there was a provision in that bill that I did not like. And the provision of the bill spelled out that the companies throughout the state could have their men checked to see if there was silicosis or asbestosis or any of these levels that were there, and that the companies then would only be liable for the aggravation or the addition to the level that was there as of 1959 and thereafter, mm-hmm. when they had their men chest x-ray and all of that. And actually, I now know that that was a wonderful provision as far as the people in Libby is concerned. Because what happened to Libby is W.R. Grace and its predecessors did, for the purpose of protecting themselves, take x-rays of the men. And so they would have the whole workforce x-rayed. And then what they did is, as the years went by, they would continue to take more x-rays. But what they would tell the men, well, it's just like it was last year. There's hardly been any change. And so basically, they would tell the men that the dust that they were working in was just like farm dust. It wasn't going to hurt you. It was dusty, all right, but it wasn't going to hurt you. So you could eat a ton of it. It wouldn't hurt you at all. And of course, they knew that dust had tremolite in it, and tremolite has these little barbs that cut back and forth in the lungs, and your lungs are as big as a tennis court to begin with, if you spread them all out. But if you have all of those little saws working away, and then you get more saws in there, and they will keep on working away, finally you get plaques, and ultimately you get a situation where it's just like an orange peel all around the lung. And ultimately, you get to a point where you can't even let out your breath, and particularly can't take a breath. And then, of course, you pass away. Mm. And that's what has happened to more mm-hmm. than 200 men up there in Libby now, and women. So,
but this particular bill that you were importantly involved in 1959 is still the basis for the state law.
Well, the key to it was, I started in 1981 bringing lawsuits against the W.R. Grace. But what I ran into to begin with was that there is the umbrella of the protection of the Workers' Compensation Act. And the only way that you could break through that protection of that umbrella was to prove that the company deliberately was misleading the men. And if you could show that the attitude of the company was, well, Joe's got it, I know that every day that goes by it's going to get that much worse, and he's going to die, well, that's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
If you could prove that kind of deliberate undertaking then you would be able to prove willful damage, which took you out of the protection of the workers' comp act, because an employer is protected under the workers' comp act for any negligent acts. Mm-hmm. But if it gets to be willful,
mm-hmm.
and that's where all of these x-rays
sure.
came in.
Yeah.
So that very provision that I did not like at all in 59 was the provision that I later used, and John Herbling and Roger Sullivan have viewed very effectively. We have something like 550 cases now, and we brought a whole series of cases up in Libby, and like for Les Gramstad, I think we got $660,000 for one case. Sometimes lawyers are criticized, but when I started, Shorty Welch was one of the first that made a claim for asbestosis, and his claim was resolved for $10,000. And I don't think that he had an attorney. I'm not sure, but that's the way it went. Well, there was a lot more damage done to Shorty Welch than $10,000.
Hmm. Yeah.
And we proved to a Libby jury that damage really is in the neighborhood of $660,000. The life plan alone, you're looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of $500,000 per man. So that was a provision in the bill.
Yeah.
That turned out to
very
be
very long range implications.
Yes, and I had no idea in 1959 of how this thing would unfold. And of course, you never know that a big company would be just so utterly wrong to not to tell the men
mm-hmm.
that when they saw the chess going bad, they wouldn't tell them about it, and they didn't. And then, of course, things began to start coming apart at the seams up there in Libby, and it's all come out. And we have now in our offices 500 exhibits on W.R. Grace that we use for punitive damage purposes, and it was the unearthing of those exhibits that I think made the United States government take note
mm-hmm.
and decide that they wanted to bring a criminal action against these folks, because some of the things that we came across was that they had some animals that they fed the asbestos dust to, and they all got lung cancer, and a lot of them, and so then this was swept under the rug.
Wow.
And so
but you can prove that now.
We can prove it now, yes. And so, but it was the W.R. Grace lying to the men. They should have said to the men, your chests are getting really a lot worse here, and we're sorry about it, but we think you ought to, you know, get out in the woods, or mm-hmm. you ought to get into some other environment other than that dusty plant. And the only reason I can ascribe, and I'm only speculating here, is they didn't want to lose their workforce. I cannot imagine why they wouldn't tell those men when they saw the signs on the x-rays there time after time. And, you know, one by one, these people started to wind up in Boot Hill up there.
I think they're in big trouble now.
They are in big trouble. They are in big trouble. Well, so those were the...
Well, you mentioned the two, and one of them was education.
Yes.
Was there any important progress made, in your opinion, in education in those two sessions?
Well, the first session, the 57 session, we made really major progress. But the problem was in the 59 session that we had given quite a bit of help to the schools in the 57 session, and I was in the I was on the education committee in the 59 session when suddenly the bill was presented to me, and it just made me furious because they were not making the kind of progress that I thought they should in the 59 session. But it was a done deal, and I don't know who cooked it up or how it got cooked. But all I know is a bill was presented in the Education Committee, and I really did everything I could to change it around, but I was just like talking to a brick wall.
You mean in terms of putting more money in it?
Yes.
Yeah, I see.
Yes. The school found the funding in the 59 session was not adequate in my mind. The funding in the 57 session was a good leap forward, but the 59 session was not and I don't know what happened there, and I don't know to this day what happened, but there must have been some pressures put on somewhere in the state. I don't think it was from Flathead County, mm-hmm. because everything that we did there, of course, was from our property taxpayers' relief in Flathead County. But I think it was from the big taxpayers in the state. They sat down and they got that bill cooked up, and it was a done deal. And I still kind of get angry when I think of that.
Do you remember, there must have been a lobbyist then for the Montana Education Association?
There was.
Who was that, do you remember?
I don't remember. But
was it a fellow named Cooper?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
D. Cooper, I think.
D. Cooper, yeah. Right. Yeah. And he was not at all happy with the 59 session going forward. 57, he was pretty pleased.
Now, Dale, we've mentioned Bill Kirkpatrick.
Yes.
And he came back as a lobbyist some years later for plywood. I think he represented the old Anaconda Company sawmills in the Missoula area, the one at Clinton and the one at Frenchtown.
Yes.
And so I was a little bit acquainted with him. And he told me he had been Western General Counsel for the Anaconda Company, which was their lead lobbyist.
Yes.
For two or three sessions back in the 1950s. So
yes.
That would square with your connecting with him back there then.
Yes.
Now, do you remember much about his lobbying techniques or anything? Do you remember much about him?
All I remember is that he was a voice crying in the wilderness as against Bob Corrette. I think that he had a lot of ability. It is just that, well, Bob had been there for years, and that there was this coalition of the Anaconda Company and the Montana Power Company in the legislature mm-hmm. for years. Bob had, he knew who the people were that he could count on, and he also knew where to go to break them loose.
Sure. And Kirkpatrick, expecting that he wouldn't have to worry about trusting Bob Corrette, wasn't right. expecting trouble from that quarter.
Yes.
And was blindsided.
Oh, he was. He was. He really was.
Well, let me tell you a story and see what this means to you. The Anaconda Company had some kind of suite of rooms in the Placer Hotel.
Yes.
And they used those rooms for hospitality and entertainment purposes. Apparently,
yes.
Were you ever there?
Yes.
Tell me about that first.
Well, I would say that most of the bills in the legislature that were really controversial bills that might affect taxation or Montana Power or the Anaconda Company, I was not, I would say, one of their favorites on the House floor at all. But there happened to be a bill that I agreed with, and I don't remember what it was. But I remember that after I voted for that bill, then suddenly I got an invitation up to the hospitality room there in the Placer Hotel. And I was kind of curious. I'd heard about it. I'd never been asked before.
But it was a by invitation kind of a thing?
Yeah.
You knew where it was. You couldn't just drop up sometime?
Well, I didn't feel comfortable about
okay.
doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Uh-huh. So, but this time, one of the lobbyists asked me to come up and invited me to come up.
You remember who that was?
No, I don't.
Denny Shea, does that ring a bell? Or Billy Ray, or Al Wilkinson? Lloyd Crippen?
It could have been O'Connor. Red Tie O'Connor.
Okay, he was a Montana Power Company guy,
yeah.
but they worked closely together.
Oh, yes. It could have been.
Okay.
Because, yeah, right.
And that was when you served in the House of Representatives with him. He went on to become the president or the CEO of some kind or other of Montana Power Company. George O'Connor did.
George, yeah.
But when you knew him, he was a representative from, I think, Stillwater County, perhaps?
Yeah.
His trademark was a red tie.
Yeah. Well, when I knew him, as I recall, I knew him at first as a lobbyist.
Okay.
And I think that, and I'm not sure it was him, but it was one of the...
Well, he had served in the House of Representatives sometime.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Maybe
right.
It was before you.
Or maybe after.
Yeah.
But at any rate, because I remember him organizing his forces in the Third House, and that's the way I recall him, not as a state representative
okay.
at that time. But at any rate, I got this invitation, and I went up to the hospitality rooms, and they had some whiskey and a lot of pop and hors d'oeuvres and that type of thing, and it was a really convivial atmosphere, and they just talked social things. It was, I would say, more of a social political meeting than anything else, and of course politics was the main subject, but nobody put any arm on me or did anything there was no pressure whatsoever. I just was invited, and I really couldn't take alcohol, so I had some 7-Up or something like that, and some hors d'oeuvres, and had a nice visit up there and left. And that
was it large? I mean, could it accommodate 40 or 50 people? Was it a lot of furniture? Or was it?
Well, there, as I recall, there was about two or three rooms together, and people could circulate some between the two or three rooms.
They were just regular hotel-sized rooms,
yes.
But there were two or three of them.
Two or three of them.
They were kind of together.
Yeah, so that they could move from place to place, and they had, in one area of it, they had the smorgasbord, so to speak, all laid out for you, and the liquor and so on.
Now, here's what Bill Kirkpatrick told me, Dale, and he told me that, I said, well, when you were Western General Counsel, he told me about this hospitality suite.
Yes.
And he said they didn't try to put any pressure on anybody there. He said there were people who dropped in on him. I understood, you probably could drop up there uninvited if you chose to. And he said, some people did, and it was fine if they did, apparently. And he said, I don't remember exactly, a couple of nights a week maybe or something like that. He said there'd be a little group of us, legislators and two or three members of his lobbying team, that would retire to some back room or some other room up there in the vicinity of their suite. And he said they'd just discuss the bills that were at various stages in the legislative process. And I said, these were legislators, right? And he said, yeah. And I said, both senators and representatives? He said, absolutely. And I said, Democrats and Republicans? He said, yeah, about equal.
Yeah.
And he said, we just talk it over. And I said, we're always the same guys? And he said, well, kind of generally. But he said, there might be somebody included from time to time, kind of depending.
Yeah.
And I said, and did you decide which bills would pass and which wouldn't pass? And he said, well, we didn't have to do that too often. Sometimes the stuff we didn't like, we just kind of encouraged not to pass, and it would collapse under its own weight. Sometimes we had to make an extra effort to get something that we wanted passed. And I said, well, if there was a really important bill, a bill that was really important to you, that you really wanted to see killed or you really wanted to see passed, what happened then? And he said, he couldn't remember very many instances where they failed to kill something that they really wanted to kill, or they failed to pass something that they really wanted to pass.
Yes, yes.
Does that sound plausible?
Well, it's not only plausible, but George Siderius was my seatmate in the 57th session of the legislature. And I learned a tremendous amount from George. And one of the things that he did, he said, you know, we've got to kind of divert this coalition. And so I've got an idea here, Dale, and I want you to take a look at it. And what he came up with was a poll tax. And the
a poll tax?
Yes. And the pitch was that when the highways are built, they are built with public funds. But then along comes the power company, and for free, they put up their poles.
In the highway right-of-way.
In the highway right-of-way. And so George put together this poll tax. And it was not an idea that he thought was going to necessarily see the governor's signature. He just wanted to divert their energies and their attentions for a while. And it did. It really did. And we all, got a kick out of it, the whole group of us. It was... one other thing that I wanted to get done was that we had a company here in connection with the power company that was pretty arrogant, and I really didn't like that arrogance.
Another utility company?
Yes.
You're talking about Pacific Power and Light Company?
I think it was Mountain States or something like that.
Or a telephone company?
No, power company.
Montana Dakota Utilities?
The one in Kalispell when I came here in 1945 or 46, and so forth.
It was something that was before Montana Power or before PP&L,
well,
maybe?
Well, it wasn't Montana Power, because I would have
sure.
remembered that.
Yeah.
But at any rate, they were very, very arrogant. And so in the 59 session of the legislature, Cy Tonner came up with this idea of public utility district legislation.
Cy Tonner was a Democratic representative from Flathead County.
From Flathead County,
At about the same time you were there.
Yes.
And what was his idea?
His idea was have public utility district legislation.
What's a public utility district?
Well, very like they have in Washington. They form a public utility district, and then the public utility district takes over the power company.
So it's like a co-op?
Very like it, but it's a condemning co-op.
I see.
And so, because the power companies are not going to step aside very lightly. And so it has the power of condemnation, and then it takes over, and you no longer do you have Montana Power, or this Mountain States Power, or whatever it was, but you have this kind of power situation. And I talked with Cy Tonner about that, and I said to Cy, well, this is a new idea, Cy, and do you really want to bring this out on the floor of the House, a brand new idea, this far-reaching, without going back to your people back in Flathead County? And Cy said, well, we ought to at least have an option, we ought to, right now, it's a monopoly, and we ought to at least have maybe some thought that, well, if you don't treat people fairly, that you might have a risk of a PUD situation. So at any rate, Cy Tonner introduced the bill. And then John Houck, who was vice president of Montana Power, and who was also my wife's uncle, came to me in the legislative session and said, Dale, this bill, we don't want it all. it's going to put us out of business, and we're going to fight this bill, and we would like to, you know, ask you, please do not support this bill. And so I went to the Democratic caucus, but in the meantime, the bill had come up in a committee in the House, and I wasn't there, but evidently the minions of Montana Power or somebody had attacked the sponsors of the bill as communists in the committee, and these people were steaming. And so I went to the caucus, and I made the same arguments that I had made to Saitama earlier. I said, you know, you folks haven't gone to your precincts. You have not discussed this at home. I know that you are really angry over this pitch that was made to you where you were being called a communist, but I don't think that this is the proper thing to do, to bring this out on the floor under these circumstances. You know, in the 59th session, we had a large Democratic majority, but these sponsors of the bill, including Cy, were just furious. And I made all this pitch and at length, and I was voted down. I told them, let's pass the bill, caucus action, just don't pass them, just lay it on the table and let it go past this session. And I couldn't get anybody to listen. And Cal Robinson came to me later and said, Dale, you know, why didn't you come to me? I think I could have given you a hand on this. And I said, well, Cal, you know, I wasn't trying to, try to get favor with people that I've been out of favor with for years. I just was saying, from a political standpoint, I don't think this was the wisest thing to do. Well, nevertheless, it came out on the House floor, and then the issue really was that I had to look at is whether or not that bill had merit. And the bill didn't have merit. There wasn't any question about that, and I voted for the bill. But then the next time that I ran for election...
Did it pass?
No, the bill was killed. But when I ran for the election, that vote, I heard about that 5 minutes to 8 every morning for 2 or 3 weeks before election.
What was that, on the radio?
Yes, yes.
And radio ads attacking you?
Yes, yes. And it was...
That would have been in 1960?
Yes. McGarvey, Sheldon, and Tonic. And Bob Keller was the one that went on the radio.
Well, Bob was the voice on the radio.
He was the voice.
And that would have been when Marshall Murray and Marshall Brink and Tom Lundgren ran?
Ran against me, yes, right. And so I lost by 400 votes, and so the people spoke.
And Tonner and Sheldon were also defeated?
Yes, yes.
And Sedarius was what, a holdover?
No, he had gone for the Senate.
That's what I mean.
And he was.
He wasn't running in that election. No, he was a holdover.
Yeah, right. And then the next time up, the next election, George Sidereus was up, and they started to attack George. And then I decided I was going to do what I had a radio program called, I think, Legislative Issues or something like that, and basically what I was doing was basically giving the Democratic program, mm-hmm. It was nothing like Bob Keller did, mm-hmm. But it was effective. I remember Marshall Murray running into me one day over, I think it was Hale funds or something, and what I had said is that that everybody, including Marshall Murray, had a right to change that bill on the floor of the House. And of course, having been a House member, I knew that any particular House member could make a change right there on the floor if he was so minded to try. And Marshall hadn't, and so I said, of course, you know, they are all in on it. And Marshall didn't care much for that.
What was the bill?
It had to do with hail.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Hail insurance?
Hail insurance. Yeah. I forget all of the details.
A couple of questions. One, you didn't ever run for the legislature again.
No, I didn't.
Why?
Well, because of the emotional reaction that Elsie had.
Elsie's your wife.
Was my wife at that time, yes. Mm-hmm. And she did not enjoy that campaign at all in 1960. Bob Keller would say such things as you don't so socialize with these Democrats. Why do you vote for them? And that hurt Elsie. I just didn't want to get into that.
I guess that leads me to the second part of the same question, really, or maybe the second question. You mentioned that even though you felt that this bill was bad politics, still there was a fair degree of merit in it, at least from your philosophical point of view, and so you felt you honestly had to support it.
Yes.
So what was the argument used against it that was so lethal? How is this bill such a poisonous thing to you and Cy Conner and Clarence Sheldon?
Well, Bob Keller attacked us on the basis that he had served in the, he had served in the war, and I think it was the Korean War, but it was where he was being, and he said that I've been shot at by these communists, and I think a lot more of them than I do of McGarvey, Sheldon, and Conner. I mean, it was a vicious attack.
The idea that co-ops, public power, are a sort of a form of socialism.
So fellow travelers, the communists.
Okay,
yes, right.
But we were still kind of on the fringe of that Red Scare era.
Yes, right. One other really interesting thing that happened is following that battle over public district legislation in the legislature, I was at the Montana Power Club in Helena.
The old Montana Club.
In the Montana Club, right. And Jack Corrett, who was president of Montana Power.
Bob Corrett's brother.
Bob Corrett's older brother, right. And of course, we knew the Corretts. And Jack, you know, John Houck was the vice president of Montana Power.
And he was Elsie's?
John Houck was Elsie's uncle.
Okay.
And so, and we never talked politics at the... when we got together at Missoula, because, you know, I would have one idea, and the idea was we'd have a nice social gathering and just keep politics out of it. But so I never really saw eye to eye with the Corretts or with John Houck. But at any rate, here I was at the Montana Club, and I was as close to Jack Corrett as I am to you. And I heard Jack say, in no uncertain terms, that, well, this is the last time that we go through this. We are going to go into the precincts. We're not going to come down here and have this type of thing that we're fighting off, you know, and our whole future at stake. We're just not going to do it again. And so we're going to go into the precincts, and we're going to change things. Well, they changed the whole legislature. Everybody lost that voted for that bill, with the exception of Francis Bardno.
Wow. So there was the Democrats had a big majority in the 59 session. The Republicans had a big majority in the 61 session.
Yes. They changed things dramatically.
Who was Speaker of the House in 59? Was it a guy named McDonald?
Johnny McDonald, yes.
Where was he from?
He was from eastern Montana, way over the... there were in the 59 session, I think it was, of the legislature, there was a rancher, an Apple Cheek rancher, and I've forgotten his name, over east of the mountains. And I liked him a lot. I used to square dance, you know, on the weekends, and, you know, mm-hmm. kind of let off some of the steam that, you know how it is. You're
sure.
It's a pressure cooker that you were in. And I got to know him very well.
He was a legislator?
He was a legislator. And there were two other legislators there called Cunningham and Dempsey.
Democrats?
Democrats.
Uh-huh. Where were they from? Butte?
Butte. And they were company crats.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't have a caucus. And, of course, they, as Democrats, they had a right to be there. And,
sure.
and we couldn't have a caucus without everything that happened to the caucus being known to the Anaconda Company, the Montana Power Company,
mm-hmm.
10 minutes after the caucus was over.
Primarily because of those two, or were there others?
Primarily because of those two. And one of the things that happened, and I don't know whether this is true or not, so all I can say is that this is what I heard, but I know this to be true. One of the days, Cunningham and Dempsey came to the House floor, and they both, you know, their faces were puffy and black-eyed, and so we asked them what had happened to them, both of them. And they said, well, they had had a little much to drink, and I believe that. and they said that they were at the head of the Capitol stairs there, and they got, you know, tangled up in each other, and they rolled down the whole stairs.
Holy smoke.
Which is quite a story. But that wasn't the story I heard when I got back home. The story was that the company, and I don't know which company it was, whether it was Anaconda or Montana Power or the Coalition or some agent of the Coalition, had offered this Eastern Montana rancher $5,000 to vote for the company for the rest of the session. And he just beat the holy bejesus out of both of them.
Because they asked him on behalf of the company to accept $5,000?
So, and buy his vote for the rest of the session.
Dempsey and Cunningham
asked
this honest rancher.
Yes.
And the response was he duped their lights out. Right?
Yes, that's exactly what happened. And
I wish you could remember his name, Dale. I wish you knew that rancher's name.
Well, I wish I could, but I don't remember the name. But
remember where he was from?
All I remember it was I know Johnny McDonald came to mind, but it was over in that area,
okay.
Fairly close.
Well, that's a good story. You know, you could probably go back and find his name in the journal or something. Was that the 57 or 59 session?
Well, let me talk to you a little later,
okay.
and I'll tell you. But I don't want to say a name and not be sure.
Sure.
And so I'll tell you later
okay.
who I think it was. But
okay.
I can't tell you now on the tape here
okay.
because I don't know for sure.
Okay.
But this is all. I didn't talk to him
sure.
personally.
No, no,
I heard but, this.
Yeah. But you hope it's true anyway.
Well, it's sure a hell of a good story, that's for sure. And I did see Cunningham and Dempsey on the House floor. And they and whoever took it into them did a real good job.
You know, do you think there was much of that that went on?
I think that...
Did you suspect any more of it?
Well, yeah, I do. There was. I think that the oil companies were pretty generous with some of the folks, and you know, I just don't know all this, but I know that some of the ladies, suddenly had nice coats and so forth, and I can't say. I can't say it was
some
enough.
Of the lady legislators.
No, their wives. Well, their wives. Suddenly, were springing mm-hmm. out with really nice fur coats and, mm-hmm. and nice things that cost some money, and I don't know, you mm-hmm. know that, but when you say that, that's all.
You suspect that it.
I suspect that there could be something more than that.
Now, the petroleum industry also had a hospitality room, I think. Didn't they have a watering hole too there?
They could have. I was never there. Yeah. I don't know what the score was. Actually, I was raised in the oil business, but I never had. I never felt that they had much influence. The ones that had the influence was the Anaconda Copper Mining Company and the Montana Power mm-hmm. Company, and that was that coalition, mm-hmm. and it was a very powerful.
Were there legislators that you suspected might have been important insiders? You've mentioned the two guys from Butte, but they don't sound like important or influential legislators.
No.
But I think the Anaconda Company would have probably tried to work with some of the more important legislators if they could.
I'm sure that they could, but that was a different situation.
Sure.
I have a lot of respect for a lot of the legislators that I think that the company was working with, and that was a difference in philosophy.
Sure, yeah.
And so it was, you know, I know men there that had a lot of the same philosophy.
Sure.
But it was a different philosophy.
But I get the honest impression that it wasn't a one-party thing.
Oh, no. No, it
wasn't.
There
were people in the Democratic Party, probably some important people in the Democratic Party.
Important people in the Democratic Party that had a different philosophy than I did.
Okay, I see.
Cal Robinson, for instance,
yes.
had a different philosophy
yeah.
than I had.
Yeah.
And I respected Cal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We just didn't see the eye to eye as to where we thought the state ought to be going.
Now, Cal never served in the legislature. Were there Democrats in the legislature that you felt were close to the Anaconda Company, or were there Republicans in the legislature that you felt were very independent of the Anaconda Company?
Well, it's difficult to say because I don't know. I was the hospitality room once, and I never got into the rooms upstairs, so I never knew what went on there. So I really don't know, but. One of the things that I did notice is in the Billings delegation, there was, I've forgotten his name, there was one man in the Billings delegation that was really all in favor of education. And they had 8 representatives at that time, very strong representation in the House. And there were really sparks between him and the other 7 members, largely because he wanted to increase the school foundation funding.
Geez, I didn't know. Was his name Schultz?
No. I could dig back in the...
Well, Jerome Anderson would have been there then.
Well, but now Jerome Anderson was a very strong legislator. A legislator that I respected, but a legislature that had totally different philosophy I had.
Okay.
And so, and there were a lot of people like that, mm-hmm. that it just as a matter of philosophy, and I give them, they have a right to their opinion, just like I have a right to mine.
Yeah.
And so I didn't agree with them at all, and Jim Feld most of the time.
Jim Hoy, was he in the
Jim,
House?
Jim Hoy?
He would have been in the House then, I think, but he wasn't the guy?
Well,
he would have been, I think he was a representative from Billings at that time.
Right, but all of these people were just had a different philosophy than I did.
But what I'm looking for is this independent Republican from Billings. And Hoy, it wasn't
Hoy.
Anderson, it wasn't
Anderson. He was big, and I don't know, it's like a Homer, it seems to be like his first name. I don't remember just the name. But I could dig back through my records and tell you who that is.
Interesting to know from the from the standpoint of the historical record. Well, you mentioned that did you ever become personally acquainted with Governor Aronson?
Yes, in the 57th session of the legislature, George Siderius was my seatmate, and he said to me, "Dale, let's go up and I want to introduce you to Johnny Holmes, and I want to introduce you to the governor."
Johnny Holmes was a state auditor.
At that time,
yeah.
Right. And so we went up to Johnny Holmes' office, and Johnny had a file drawer, and he brought out Jack Daniels or something very like it, and gave me more alcohol than I really wanted. I don't drink, I just, it doesn't do me any good. I like a beer, but as far as the straight stuff, I didn't care for it, but I didn't want to be, so we visited with Johnny, and I liked Johnny a lot. And so then we went up to the governor, and George Siderius introduced me, and Hugo Aronson said, "Well, I think I know you." And I said, "Oh?" And he said, "Well, you're the little boy that put in that tire iron in my big tire, and it blew out. And this is the first thing I knew about it." My dad, I knew, had a lot of work for Hugo Aronson. My dad got his start was up there in the oil fields.
Okay. So Aronson was a oil man, an oil well developer up in the Cutbank area.
Well, it was Oilmont.
Oilmont.
Yes.
And so that's where your family's from?
Well, that's where my dad got his start financially.
And he
made enough money in fixing Hugo Aronson's tires that he was able to come down to Conrad and establish a service station in the midst of the Depression.
Okay.
So at any rate, Hugo Aronson had these big tires, and he had these big oil rigs, and of course he'd blow out a tire, and my dad was the only one that he would trust to go rebuild the tire, and he paid my dad very well for doing that, and of course it probably helped him a lot in the oil fields there, because a brand new tire would cost a heck of a lot more than the repair.
Yeah.
So that's that, and evidently what I did when I was, younger than six, I must have been three or four or five or somewhere in there, as evidently I carried this tire iron around and I was just playing, and I put it inside the tire and my dad didn't know it.
Oh, no.
And he put it all together and it went out there, and that was the best thing.
Great, terrible mischief for the tire.
Yeah, right.
We're getting close to the end of our
tape,
I want to ask you about two people. I want to ask you about General Leroy Anderson.
Yes.
Because you would have maybe had some association with him from Conrad.
Yes.
And just, any thoughts or observations about him. And then also Attorney General and later Congressman Arnold Olson.
Well, Leroy Anderson I didn't have much contact with, but I did have a lot of contact with Arnold Olson.
Okay.
Arnold Olson was in the 57th session. He had run against Hugo Aronson, and Aronson
for governor in 56.
For governor, Governor Aronson beat him. And
well, I was thinking he was still Attorney General when you were a legislator, but I guess that's not right, is it? Forrest Anderson would have come in in 56.
Yes.
Okay, well, you might have some thoughts about him too, but keep talking about Arnold.
Well, at any rate, there was a strong feeling that Arnold Olson had, and I remember Ernie Salvas from Butte.
Ernie was who?
Ernie Salvas was the lobbyist for the mine workers in Butte.
Okay.
And I remember Arnold Olson. Well, basically, what was happening there and is that there were bills that were being introduced that basically I thought were you know, kind of fighting the gubernatorial campaign all over again. And I listened, but I was not much taken with that effort because I didn't think it was going to be successful, and it was not successful. But I remember that Arnold and Ernie Salvas did do some things there that brought major issues to
the floor of the House in the 57
floor,
session.
Yeah, in the 57
that were
session.
Echoes from Arnold Olson's point of view of the 1956 campaign. And
right.
The Democrats have the majority in 57?
Barely.
Okay.
We had a good majority, and Gene Mahoney was Speaker of the House
in 57.
And what happened in the early days of 57 is that we had such a small majority that our men would split, and the Republicans were running the House. And so George Sidiris and I went to Gene and said, "We've got to have caucuses here. We can't have this. We're going to be responsible when we go back to the people, and we just can't have this situation where, you know, the Republicans are on major controversial are winning the day." So then Gene, who's kind of laid back, he wasn't as strong some of the others, but once we kind of put a bean in his bonnet, we did have caucuses, and that never happened again. We did what we wanted to do in the 57 session, and when we came back from the 57 session, we were really well liked all over the county. We'd done what we said we'd do. We didn't get silicosis through, but we sure tried.
Yeah.
And we sure did a lot about education and the people like that.
We're getting close to the end of the tape. Forrest Anderson, if there are any thoughts or impressions about him, or any other legislator or any other lobbyist, or anything you'd like to say in conclusion.
Well, as far as Forrest Anderson, I want to tell you a story about the soldier home in Columbia Falls. What happened is it was Babcock and his administration had decided that the soldiers' home had outlived its usefulness, basically, and what they were going to do is transfer the men from the soldiers' home to another institution, and I forgot what it was, but it had to do with silicosis, but it certainly didn't have to do with the soldiers, and so that there was that effort on. And so I was asked to bring an injunction, and Charlie Hanks and I brought the injunction against the closure of the soldiers' home.
When would this have been, in the 60s?
It was close to when Kennedy was assassinated.
63 or 64?
Somewhere in there, mm-hmm. Maybe. 62, 63, somewhere in, mm-hmm, there. At any rate, the upshot of it was that we then went before Judge Haswell, got the temporary restraining order, and we restrained everybody, including the driver. That they were not to move, and the idea was to move the women out, and of course once that was done, the men would dress up or, you know, things would go to hell in a handcart. And the way, mm-hmm, it was, you know, with women there, they would come down and everything was pretty nice, you know. And so at any rate, we stopped the whole thing cold, and then we had a hearing before Judge Haswell on the whether or not the final injunction should be granted, And so the state then came over and offered us everything that we wanted in behind the scenes. And Forrest Anderson came over.
And he was then Attorney General.
He was Attorney General. And he said, Dale, well, now you do what you want to do. But if you make peace here and behind the scenes, there's going to be a release. But nobody will really know or believe what happened. So I'm saying to you, you've got a good case. Go out there and put it in the evidence before the court. And so that's exactly what we did at Forrest's advice. And Judge Haswell then granted the permanent injunction. And the veterans all had, you know, they saw the evidence, they saw the whole thing, and even though the state was willing to throw in the sponge totally, Forrest was entirely right. That was the thing to do. Mm-hmm. And then we had an injunction. We won the day, and the soldier home is still there. And so I don't know whether Forrest thought that, you know, if we make peace, you know, the next time around, things may not break quite as well for the soldiers and the veterans and so forth, because we had the whole state was stirred up over this.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lot of the legislators that I served with there at the hearing. They came from eastern Montana, a whole raft of them.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my about the first and only contact with Forrest Anderson.
Okay.
But I certainly, yeah. You know, he was a little general, and he politically, he knew what the thing was to do, and mm-hmm. we did it,
yeah.
and it worked.
And it worked.
Yes.
Anything you want to say in conclusion?
Well, the only thing that I would say is that if you're a younger lawyer like I was, that you ought to run for the legislature at least twice. because you're going to learn, whether you run as a Democrat or a Republican, you're going to learn a lot about this state. You're going to make tremendous friends that are going to last you a lifetime in every county in this state, and you just should do it. You should do it when you're starting out, when you're before you get tied up in the major cases that you can't really take off.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of months. But I certainly would recommend that to any young lawyer coming up, that they should do that, because it's something that they'll remember all their lives, and you can make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And not only then, but you're going to be able to know the movers and the shakers.
Sure.
Throughout the state, and so when later issues come up, like they have in asbestos or the Montana Power case that we have, or any of those major issues, you kind of know
mm-hmm.
a lot that you can only learn if you go to the legislature.
That's right. Yeah, I believe that to be true too. Well, sure appreciate the interview very much, Dale.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.